Good afternoon. I will now call this meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:38 p.m. on Tuesday, May 2nd, 2022, or 23. Where'd that come from? Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum. Present today is Senator Lukey Tobin and also Senator Rob Myers. So staffing the committee today is LIO Moderator Doug Bridges and Johanna Crossett from Records, and our Transportation Committee aide, Emma Torkelson. So at this time, I'd like to remind everyone to turn off or silence your cell phones. Today's agenda will consist of two items, SB 127 by Senator Klayman, and then we will hear HB 128 by the House Transportation Committee. First, we'll have Senate Bill 127. This is the second hearing of SB 127. Today, it is my intention to consider a committee substitute, take public testimony, and if it is the will of the committee, to move this bill to its next committee of referral. With that, we will begin by taking up CS for SB 127. So, Senator Tobin, can I?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move committee substitute for Senate Bill 127, version 33-LS0635-S. Before the committee as our working document.
Thank you, and I will object just to be difficult. I mean for a conversation. So please, Ms. Torkelson, if you will read through the summary of changes.
Through the chair to Senator Kaufman. Thank you, Emma Torkelson, staff to Senator Kaufman and the Senate Transportation Committee. The explanation of changes for SB 127 version B to version S are as follows. Section 2, page 2, lines 1 through 3, removes the original language and adds a reference to new subsection C created in section 3. Section 2, page 2, lines 4 through 6, adds language requiring vehicle rental platform companies collecting vehicle rental tax to pay the tax quarterly. Section 3, page 2, lines 8 through 11, creates new subsection C, requiring a vehicle rental platform that arranged or executed more than 200 transactions in the state in the preceding calendar year to collect and pay to the department the taxes imposed under AS 4352010 through 4352099. Section 3, page 2, lines 12 through 17, creates new subsection D, clarifying that a vehicle rental platform company is not liable for failing to collect or pay the vehicle rental tax if they were provided with incorrect or insufficient information. The company must demonstrate that a reasonable effort was made to obtain the correct or sufficient information from the vehicle owner. Section 3, page 2, lines 26 through 28, defines, quote, vehicle rental platform company, end quote, as a company whose primary business is arranging or executing the rental of vehicles through a vehicle rental platform.
Thank you very much. So, thank you. I will now remove my objection to adopting the CS as our working document. Is there any further objection? None noted. So, seeing none, the committee substitute for SB 127 version S has been adopted as our working document. I'd like to invite Senator Klayman and his staff, Lizzie Kubitz, to come up and talk to us through the purpose of the changes made in the committee substitute in front of us.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lily Kipitz. I'm staff to Senator Klayman.
And I'm Senator Matt Klayman.
The changes in the CS before you were changes that we discussed with Turo. The first major change was adding a substantial nexus standard, which we discussed in the last committee, of 200 transactions. And the goal was to not impose the requirement to collect and remit taxes on platforms with minor activity. And we didn't want to impose the requirement on platforms such as Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace, where some hosts are executing their transfers of money, not through the actual platform, but separately, person to person. The second major change was the provision clarifying that a platform is responsible for organizing and filing the documentation related to the taxes. And the third was the provision that platforms collecting the tax are not liable for information provided to them by the host or vehicle owner. And all three of these changes were changes that Turo had recommended and we agreed to.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Senator Mars.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies to the committee. I wasn't here for the first hearing of the bill, so I just, it's not so much about the committee substitute, just kind of just a few questions in general about the bill, just kind of for my own background information. The definition that we've got here for motor vehicle that's self-propelled except moved by human or animal power. We had another bill go through here not too long ago about e-bikes, and I know there's a number of bike rental companies, and you know, they're spreading as well, so I wouldn't be too surprised if one of them showed up in state here in not too long. How would this bill affect e-bike rental?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I would certainly, I know that one of the e-bike legislation passed the House and I think is now under consideration in the Senate, and I would actually have a research act, but my initial answer would be that if that e-bike bill passes, that that would make it treat e-bikes like a self-propelled bike, so that that would mean e-bikes wouldn't be included within this structure.
Okay.
That's how, that would be my initial take.
Understood. Understood. I've got a half a dozen questions, Mr. Chairman. That's your prerogative if I keep going.
I'd say go ahead, and if you can, just run through your questions quickly.
Sure, sure. Another one, looking over the history that was provided in the bill packet, talking about the history of the rental car tax, I noticed that I think it was in 2016 that motorcycles were pulled out. Do you know why motorcycles aren't taxed anymore as a rental?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I don't.
Okay. Discussed this one a little bit earlier with the department outside of committee, but this bill fixes how we collect the tax if it comes to Turo or a similar platform. But if I understand correctly, if I loaned my car to a friend and, you know, let's say I'm moving or he's moving and he borrows my pickup and gives me $40 for gas or something like that, I could potentially be on the hook for a tax if the state found out about it. Or another version of that, last year as I was getting prepared to come down here for session, my wife got a hold of a military couple that was moving up into our area, and the military had informed them that their car was being shipped, but it wasn't going to make it for a month or two. Ended up falling through, but we had talked about the possibility of them renting our car for a month or two until their vehicle got there. Even after this bill passed, I would still technically be liable for a vehicle rental tax. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, you actually asked two different questions. One is when you loan your car to your neighbor and he gives you $40 for gas, and I would answer that that's not a rental agreement. That's loaning to your friend in the same way that your friend would loan to you, and there's no charge for the rental. He's just basically filling the tank for the use that he did. So the gas was a friendly thing, but the loan is a friendly exchange that wouldn't be subject to the tax. Mm-hmm. With regard to the military person, that rental would be subject to the tax as long as it was less than 90 days. But if the rental was for more than 90 days, because the excise tax passed in 2003 only applies to rentals of 90 days or less. If you were over 90 days, there'd be no tax liability. Under 90 days, yes, I think you would be subject to tax liability. Whether or not the Department of Revenue would have any means of discovering that you made that agreement might be more of a challenge.
Understood. Okay. How do we know, or what do you know about how prices between Turo and regular rental car companies, how they compare pre-tax? Just curious, what's the marketplace treating them like right now?
Through the chair, I only have anecdotal experience. A few years ago, my wife and I were traveling state. We were looking at rentals. Rentals were hard to find because apparently there was a whole cycle in COVID when car rentals had fewer stock and then suddenly people wanted them. Mm-hmm. In that time, it turned out the Turo rentals were more expensive than the traditional car rentals, and we ran it through the traditional. In very recent weeks, my daughter, who now lives on a state, was renting a car, and I asked her specifically because this bill was going on. I said, how does it compare? And her answer was the price was basically the same between Turo and the rental, the traditional rental companies. And she went with Turo because she's interested in a particular vehicle that she might buy. And if she, on Turo, she could know she was driving that car, whereas if she were renting from Hertz or Avis or another company, there was no certainty that for the weekend rental she'd get the car she wanted to test drive. So, but she said the prices were fairly equivalent.
That's an interesting way to figure out a test drive. That's good. I'll have to remember that.
She didn't learn that from her father.
I had heard this kind of through the grapevine, and I was wondering if you had some backup information on this. For rental car companies, approximately what percentage of their business comes from folks coming in from out of state versus in state?
I have no information through the chair. I have no information. I would note that Kerrigan Grigsby, who is affiliated with the Avis franchise here in the state, could probably give you a better answer.
Okay. Yeah. If he could answer that question, it'd be appreciated.
Kerrigan Grigsby, if you could put yourself on the record, if you can answer that question.
Yeah. Through the chair. Hello, this is Kerrigan Grigsby with Avis Alaska. I'm trying to think if like I'm giving up too much proprietary information here. I don't think so. But it's a large portion. I mean, out of state would be, I mean, really our months are May through September is where the bulk of the rentals come from. And it would be, I mean, a substantially larger number, maybe 3-1, maybe even a little bit more than that, out of state versus in state.
That's fair. Thank you. That was kind of what I was expecting. Mr. Grigsby or Senator Klayman, do either of you have rough information for where the Turo rentals come from, if they're primarily in-state or out-of-state, then too?
This is Senator Klayman. Again, very anecdotal. I talked to a Turo owner in recent days, and I asked kind of a similar question. It was a pretty similar answer that in summer months, kind of tour season, it's much more out of state, and in the non-tour season, it's more in state.
Okay. And then my final question just kind of had to do with what was the point of Section 1 of the bill? I saw when the bill first got introduced last week or a couple weeks ago that it was said that it was just removing extraneous language, and I mean you don't usually pull just for extraneous. I was curious what the point of Section 1 was.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, the Department of Law and Department of Revenue, when we were drafting the bill, they had specifically asked us to include that language. My understanding is a combination of what they reported in my own experience, that in my own experience as a trial attorney, serving out-of-state subpoenas where you would need to file a lawsuit in another state to get a subpoena out of that court is incredibly complicated, and whereas going to your local state court and getting a subpoena issued and then having the state serving the state court from Alaska in another jurisdiction was at some levels easier as a procedural matter, but it still raises somewhat complicated issues because even though you have an order from the state court of Alaska, that doesn't automatically mean somebody will serve that for you in another state. And I think if Department of Law is available, they could probably give you a better detailed perspective of their thinking, or Department of Revenue. But I know that whenever you're getting involved in subpoenaing records in other states, it's complicated.
Okay.
If I may say too, it's part of this, I think, the streamlining and aligning with the current online business practices that we weren't aligned with. So a big part of this is not so much a new tax as much as just trying to align the processes around it, including how do you deal with an out-of-state supplier that doesn't have a physical presence in the state.
Just quick follow-up on that. What's the opinion of the Alaska court system on this change?
We haven't inquired.
Okay. Thank you. That finishes my questions, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Well, do we have any other questions from the committee? So now we would like to move to invited testimony. We have a number of folks online and in the room. First, we have Commissioner Crum and Deputy Commissioner Fadil Lamani and Brandon Spanos from the Department of Revenue. Would you like to approach, and do you have any testimony to provide today, or are you here to answer questions only?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Adam Crum, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue. Just here to answer questions, and also just to offer that appreciate that the committee hearing this bill for Senator Klayman for sponsoring it. This is an item that, as we determine the responsibility to collect this tax is on the department, this is a bill that we see as a protecting of Alaskans, that it adds some compelling language just for the online rental platforms to collect and remit the tax back to the state, so the state and the department don't have to go after individual car owners and hosts. So this is an item that we see as a relatively straightforward bill. It is something that is important for Alaskans. It allows tourism, it allows economy to continue on, and it just takes advantage of technology in order to collect and remit this tax, which is a statutory obligation.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Senator Tobin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to Senator Meyer's question regarding motorcycles, do you or maybe Director Spanos might have an answer as to why motorcycles are no longer taxed under this?
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, I did a brief search on that, and HB8 actually has a definition of electric-assisted bicycles is how they define e-bikes under that. So how that actually holds with taxing, I don't know that, and I would defer to see if Deputy Director Spanos actually has an answer to that, or Deputy Commissioner Fadil Lamani. He may not.
So for the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Department of Revenue Tax Division. When the tax was first passed, vehicle rental was a pretty broad definition, and it basically said if you could have more than one, a driver plus a passenger was a passenger vehicle. The department interpreted that as including motorcycles. Motorcycles were being rented, so the department began assessing a tax on motorcycles. The motorcycle, the company that was running the motorcycles went to the legislature and said, this doesn't seem right, found a sponsor. There was an amendment to change the statute. So they removed motorcycles because it was the intent of the legislature not to tax motorcycles as a vehicle rental. To the point on e-bikes, currently in statute, a vehicle is described as a motor vehicle. So an e-bike would not be taxed under the current statute.
Thank you, Mr. Banos. Any other questions? All right. Now we also have Kerrigan Grigsby, who responded earlier. But Mr. Grigsby, do you have any comments or further explanation that you may want to give on SB 127? Hello, Mr. Grigsby. It appears you're on mute. If you're speaking, we can't hear you.
I apologize. Sorry about that. Yeah, we support this. I'm sorry, through the chair. This is Kerrigan Grigsby with Avis, Alaska. We support the updated CS.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Grigsby? And I just wanted to note for the record that we did invite representatives from Turo to attend electronically, but they were unable to make it. Thank you, Mr. Grigsby. Do we have no further questions for Mr. Grigsby? Senator Klayman, do you, your staff, or do we have, I'm sorry, for the commissioner, or do we have any questions for our attendees. So, all right, if we can, now we'll go to Senator Klayman.
Thank you.
And just see if you have any additional comments or anything that you would like to add. No? All right, fair enough. And so I will now open public testimony on SB 127. So is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? It appears there's no one in the room. Is there anyone online that would like to testify? It appears we have no online testifiers. Three? Okay. Okay, there we go. Mackenzie Chase with Expedia Group, are you available?
Good afternoon, Chair Kaufman and members of the Senate Transportation Committee. Thank you so much for the afternoon to offer comments, or the opportunity this afternoon to offer comments. I'm here on behalf of Expedia Group, a travel platform that partners with hotels, vacation rentals, airlines, cruise lines, and car rental companies to provide the broadest offerings in the travel industry. I shared these comments via email, but I wanted to follow up verbally and see if I could be available to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, if you could, please hold your comments to about 3 minutes. Thank you.
Expedia Group strongly supports ensuring that all vehicle rental taxes are collected and remitted to the state of Alaska. However, we are concerned that under the current draft of the legislation, online travel agents like Expedia would be newly responsible for collecting and remitting vehicle rental taxes. Traditional rental car companies excel at calculating and collecting car rental taxes, so there is no significant tax leakage. Expedia Group also has agreements in place with car rental suppliers, companies like Avis and Hertz, that are listed on our platform that the rental company suppliers will continue to pay appropriate taxes. Shifting this requirement to online travel agents will net no additional revenue and is cumbersome and will likely increase tax leakage. Expedia Group is not the best to collect taxes for car rentals because we don't have the ability to accurately forecast the cost of the car rental on which taxes must be paid. For example, if someone gets a discount or upgrades their vehicle at the car rental desk, we don't have access to that information in advance. The FAQ and the comments around this indicate that the intention is to ensure that vehicle rental taxes are properly collected and remitted and to address potential gaps in tax collections from peer-to-peer car rentals. So we would ask that you would amend the legislation to clarify that online travel agents are not subject and responsible. For example, at the April 20th hearing, you looked at Anchorage legislation that was cited as a model. That bill exempts tour companies and travel booking agents specifically to ensure that taxes are still collected, but online travel agents are not responsible. We would request that you add similar language to this legislation. Happy to answer any questions, and again, thank you so much for the opportunity to offer comments today.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the committee? No questions noted. Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
All right. Moving now to Hannah Noble, testifying on behalf of herself from Palmer. Are you there, Hannah?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Please give us your testimony, put yourself on the record, and we'll allocate 3 minutes to your time.
Okay. My name is Hannah Noble, and I'm a co-host on Turo, and I'm against SB 127 because it's specifically going after Turo. And I would really like to see something needs to specify that hosts and guests are not liable for the tax. And I'm also against the ambiguous retro tax collection that has happened. And I just feel like there's a few things that need to be specified in here that are not. That's about it.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions from the committee? I see no questions. Thank you for testifying today. All right. At this time, I don't see anyone else online. And so I will close public testimony. So, Senator Klayman, would you like to respond to any of the public testimony or any other questions that may have come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Matt Klayman. The question raised by the public testimony from the Expedia group, that concern is actually addressed in the CS. If you look at the original version of the bill in subsection C of AS 4352-050, there's only two subsections listed. And if you look at the CS, there's now a subsection 3 that identifies vehicle rental platform company means a company whose primary business is arranging or executing the rental of vehicles through a vehicle rental platform. And the purpose of this subsection, and I believe that was this was more added at the request of your office, Mr. Chair, but that the specific effect of that is to mean a company like Expedia, who has many different arrangements they're booking, and they are not primarily in the business of vehicle rentals. They're actually primarily in the business of booking travel in all kinds of media, or not all kinds, but all kinds of forms, and they book for far more than just rental car companies. They would not be a business that was primarily in the business of arranging executing rental cars. They'd be all the things that she described. And so this additional subsection on page 2, lines 26 through 28, is the provisions that would make it so that Expedia and similarly situated groups would not be covered by this, and they could rely on the collection efforts by traditional rental car companies to collect those taxes.
Thank you for that, Senator Klayman. I know we looked at things like, you know, let's say Craigslist, organizations that are not primarily operating this function that could be caught up, and it would create an undue burden on them. So are there any other questions from committee members? So we do have one amendment before the committee that I'm offering, and I will move Amendment 1. Do I have an objection?
I will object for purpose of discussion.
All right. The purpose of Amendment 1 is very simple. It's simply to, on page 3, line 1, to delete the one-year requirement and insert 6 months. And then again on page 3, line 4, delete 1 year and insert 6 months. And that's just to close the window for resolution of any back taxes. So any questions from the committee? All right.
I remove my objection.
Do I have a motion? Okay, that's right. Just adopt. That was too easy. So you come in and expecting a fight. You're not ready. Okay, so thank you, Senator Tobin. It's been a hectic day of preparation, so I thank all for your forbearance. So let's see. Thank you. I guess we talked about, again, the reason for this, back taxes and the collecting of all of it. We just want to be sure that we're not creating an undue burden. We feel that this is enough time to solve any of the major problems that may be there, but not get bogged down in a long duration. So do we have any other questions or comments on this moving forward? Senator Klayman, do you have any further discussion? With that, no further objection. Of course, Amendment 1 passes, and we, let's see, so brief at ease. We're back on the record. So, Senator Tobin, do I have a motion?
I do. Mr. Chairman, I move Transportation Committee substitute for Senate Bill 127, version 33-LS0635-S from committee with the attached individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
With that, SB 127 moves from the Senate Transportation Committee. Let's take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork, transition to the next agenda item. All right. We are back on the record. Next, we'll hear an introductory presentation of House Bill 128 by the House Transportation Committee. It's my intention to hear from the sponsor, take invited testimony, public testimony, set an amendment deadline, hold the bill for further consideration. With that, we'll begin presenting the bill to the committee today. Is Mr. Buddy Witt, staff to Representative McCabe in the House Transportation Committee. Representative McCabe has another hearing in House Finance and will join us as soon as he can. Mr. Witt, please place yourself on the record and begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Kaufman, and members of the Senate Transportation Committee. My name is Buddy Witt. I'm staff to Representative McCabe. I apologize on behalf of the representative. He wishes he could have been here, but he's currently in another bill hearing. If he's able to finish in time, he'll come right back down and thank you personally. I put together a somewhat brief slide presentation, I'm going to warn you it's a little wordy, but I thought it important to give you some background into how this bill came to be and the reason concerns were brought to Representative McCabe's attention and thus had the committee bill introduced and has now come before you. I want to bring your attention to Regulation 18 AAC 75.432, subsection B, which reads, and this is talking about response and planning requirements and response requirements for different types of entities. In this particular case, we're talking about oil terminal facilities. But in this, it says in subsection B, the response planning standard volume for a crude or non-crude oil terminal facility is equal to the capacity of the largest oil storage tank at the facility covered by the plan, that is their spill prevention and plans, unless there are specific natural or man-made conditions outside the facility which could place the facility at an increased risk of an oil discharge affecting one or more storage tanks. It's a lot of word salad there. It's pretty straightforward, though. Next one I'll bring to you is 18 AAC 75.432B. And the last sentence says, for vessels operating as oil terminal facilities, the response planning standard is based on the entire storage capacity of the vessel. So, again, for a crude or non-crude oil terminal facility, it's equal to the capacity of the largest oil storage tank. For vessels acting or operating as oil terminal facility, the response planning standard is based on the entire storage capacity of the vessel. That's what this says. So these were items that were this past year, a regulatory review done by the Department of Environmental Conservation had these pieces of language in, and this was brought to the attention of the Alaska Fuel Storage and Handlers Alliance. They asked that they delete some of the language and ask for clarification on when an oil terminal facility is considered, or when a vessel is considered an oil terminal facility and when it's not. Because the planning standard requirements for an oil terminal facility is based on their largest tank, and subsequent language was put in that says that vessels operating as an oil terminal facility have to have a response planning standard that's based on the entire storage capacity of the vessel, it could create a lot of confusion, a lot of concern. Treating a vessel, the definition in 18 AAC 75.990, this is a response from DEC for oil terminal facility, answers the commenter's question. And they point out the definition of oil terminal facility in statute. And this brought folks from the Alaska Fuel Storage and Handlers Alliance and other folks who are involved in the business of transferring fuel from point A to point B or doing ship-to-ship transfers, it caused them some concern. There is a different fuel storage standard for vessels than there are for oil terminal facilities because you treat the spills differently. You treat prevention differently. There are different facility, land-based facility isn't going to run into waves. It's not going to run into 20-foot seas. It's a vessel isn't going to They both have different things, different liabilities, different causations that they have to take into consideration. The current statutory definition of oil terminal facility then is the question. And the question that we are trying to address in this bill is if there is enough differentiation between oil terminal facilities when they're acting as vessels, and is there enough differentiation and specificity in the requirements of a vessel when they're acting as an oil terminal facility. So this was, it was originally brought to the bill sponsor, to the committee, that the definition of oil terminal facility itself needs to be changed to do a carve out for vessels when they're operating as oil terminal facilities, to say you are covered as long as you are, you have the required insurance for a vessel that is acting as an oil terminal facility, and you have the correct oil spill and mitigation plans in place when you're acting as a terminal oil terminal facility. But the definition of itself doesn't make those carve-outs. All it says in the second half of the definition is a vessel other than a non-tank vessel is considered an oil terminal facility when it is used to make ship-to-ship transfer of oil or when it is traveling in order to conduct those type of operation. And so there is a concern that was raised that there is not enough, there's a little bit too ambiguous, and in the definitions are a little bit too muddled. So we, the Transportation Committee over in the other body, undertook this and decided to try to make the changes necessary so that the operation, standard operating procedures will continue. DEC still has their standards for vessels when they're operating. Oil terminal facilities still have their standards for operating, but specificity of what are the requirements for a vessel when they are operating as an oil terminal facility. Oil terminal facility has a meaning given in ASO. The regulatory definition of oil terminal facility, again, points back to 4604-900. 18 AAC 75.2AO lays out the details of classification of oil facility. I put this in here just to make sure you understood that there are very clear differences between an oil terminal facility and a vessel. And just run through the bullet points. So Alaska statutes require land-based oil terminals and vessels that deliver oil as cargo to have oil spill response plans known as contingency plans. Land-based terminals have a planning standard that requires equipment to respond to a spill from their largest tank, no matter what that size of tank is. If it's land-based, you have to have a planning standard based upon a spill from that largest tank. Vessel operators have a planning standard that's quite different. It requires equipment to respond to a spill from a percentage of their total cargo. Just quite simply, there's not enough manpower and equipment that can fit on a ship to take care of a spill from its largest tank as you would have on land-based. The planning standards differ because responding to a spill on land is different than on water, obviously, and commingling and lack of clarity regarding the definition of oil terminal facility is causing concern from these fuel delivery vessel operators in Alaska. And it appears that the definition of oil terminal facility that includes vessels that transfer fuel to smaller vessels in state waters now requires vessels that already have oil spill plans to now plan for and acquire tens of millions of dollars of new equipment to comply with oil terminal facility planning requirements. Whether or not that was the intent of the department, and we do not believe that it was the intent of the department, but the concern is that's the plain reading of the statute now that there's been these regulatory changes. The additional requirements and the financial commitments to meet them are a concern to stakeholders, because the requirement will cost time and money, which will be passed on to customers. And I'll remind you that very quickly, if not already, approaching the fuel delivery season here in Alaska, particularly in rural Alaska. So that brings us to the sectional analysis of the bill. And before I go into this, the first iteration of this bill, version A, had simply a change in the definition itself. We thought that would work, but attorneys pointed out to us that we were wrong, and putting a carve out when there was already a carve out created an issue that I don't even know if I can describe, but it wasn't great. So this version of the bill, version uniform of the bill, section 1 starts at page 1, goes from line 4 through line 11, and adds language that an approved contingency plan for a tank vessel or oil barge satisfies the requirements in A of this section for contingency plans for oil terminal facilities. Section 2, page 1, lines 12 through page 2, excuse me, section 2, page 1, line 12 through page 2, line 6, has similar language, but it is adds language that the proof of financial ability for a tank or oil barge, tank vessel or oil barge, that is approved satisfies the requirements for the proof for financial ability for oil terminal facility. And then page 3, or section 3, page 2, lines 12 through 26, it changes the definition, but it does so in a different way. It points back and says that an oil terminal facility that changes the definition to conform to the additions of section 1 and section 2, and it specifies that when a tank vessel or oil barge are operating with approved contingency plans and proof of financial ability, they are no longer considered an oil terminal facility. And finally, section 4 adds a immediate effective date for the bill. And that's all I have.
Well, thank you, Mr. Witt. Do we have any questions from the committee? Senator Myers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Witt, you mentioned ship-to-ship transfer. What about ship-to-shore transfer? Does that also qualify, make the ship now qualify as an oil terminal?
Through the chair, to answer Senator Myers' question, I should have prefaced my remarks by saying we do have some experts in the field that I will be diverting most of these questions to. And so in this particular case, there is an attorney online named Mr. Jim Butler, who is an expert in the law and in the law as it applies to this section. So,
and we'll be moving to them in just a moment. If we can, I had online for testimony, Kevin O'Shea, president of the Alaska Fuel Storage and Handlers Alliance. Mr. O'Shea, if you're there, please put yourself on the record.
My name is Kevin O'Shea. I'm the president of the Alaska Fuel Storage and Handlers Alliance. We are a group of petroleum transporters and terminals throughout the state of Alaska. And we saw this come up in the reg change, and it gave us concern because now being put into regulation the way it was written, we had concern that our insurance carriers would not cover us in the event that something happened, because we would be in direct violation of the statute and the regulation.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Any questions for Mr. O'Shea?
Just same question. I'm not sure if he's the correct one or Mr. Butler's the correct one to ask. Mr. O'Shea, had a question. We talked about ship-to-ship transfer. My question is what applies if we're talking ship-to-shore transfer? Do we also need this bill to apply there as well?
There's a little caveat on that, is that if a vessel is involved in a ship-to-ship or barge-to-barge transfer and it is over 10,000 barrels, from the point of that transfer to its further destination, it is classified as a terminal, and that would apply to some of the barges going into the villages. So there are times that certain barges would be considered a terminal even while they were located at a terminal.
Okay.
Follow up?
A little bit, yeah. So, Mr. O'Shea, I don't know if you know this or not, but last I knew, this was about 8 years ago, while Alaska produces a lot of jet fuel, we don't produce, again, last I knew, any avgas. Do you know if that is still the case?
I believe that is the case. To my knowledge, all the supplies that are coming in for delivery through Western Alaska and so forth are coming foreign.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, comment to that. My point going down that line of questioning was, while we're talking about this primarily in terms of delivering gasoline and heating oil and stuff to the villages, avgas is not something we produce in state. And if you have to have this change for ship to shore as well, then if we don't pass this bill, then this summer every prop plane in this state is going to be grounded.
Thank you. So noted. And I want to note for the record that Representative McCabe entered the room at 2:25 p.m. So, Rep. McCabe, your staffer has been doing a great job with this compelling PowerPoint. That, and so at this point, we've heard the presentation on the bills, the sectional, and now we're taking the testimony online, and we have your support team for questions. Would you like to put yourself on the record and just maybe weigh into the conversation?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the indulgence. I'm sorry I'm late. I appreciate you hearing this bill. This was brought to us by the Alaska AFHC, Alaska Fuel Group, that uses these barges for transferring fuel back and forth, and they identified an issue with the language, and really all it does is tighten up the language to their satisfaction. It doesn't really create any other impediment to the state, or doesn't restrict the state at all. It just tightens up the language for all parties, and we had much discussion over several weeks with all the stakeholders, and I think this is the path forward for them. I think it's the Alaska Fuel Handlers Group.
So Alaska Fuel Storage and Handlers Alliance.
Yes, that's what it is. Those guys. Yeah, those guys. Anyways, I appreciate your indulgence, and I'm sure that Mr. Witt has done an admirable job. And with that, I'll let you get to it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Today's been kind of rocky. We've been indulging each other quite a bit to try and get through this committee hearing. So I'm glad you're able to make it. We had just heard the testimony of Kevin O'Shea, president of the Alaska Fuel Storage and Handlers Alliance. Mr. O'Shea, did you have any additional commentary to offer?
Just that we fully support the bill as it is moved over to the Senate, and hope that you will move it on and resolve the issue for those of us in the industry.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you for your testimony today. If you can, maybe stay with us in case any questions come up. Mr. Witt, I think you had a question on the tip of your tongue.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to take a crack, because I'm anxious to hear the response from Mr. Butler on Senator Myers' question when we get there, but I wanted to take a crack at it. I wanted to point out that oil terminal facilities vessels, these vessels are only considered oil terminal facilities when they are either doing ship-to-ship or on their way to doing ship-to-ship. The fuel, the Alaska Fuel Storage and Handlers Alliance, they do other types of fuel delivery as well. It's only in those certain instances when they're considered oil terminal facilities. All the rest of the time, they are covered and on the regular operating basis. I don't think that there is the need to add any other caveats to the bill, Mr. Butler would know for sure.
So thank you. Mr. Butler, would you like to weigh in on that? Put yourself on the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jim Butler. I'm checking in from Kenai today, so I appreciate you allowing me the opportunity to address HB 128 and its importance. You've heard an awful lot already, so I won't go over it in too much detail, but sometimes it's good to use an example of how this situation that was identified adds considerable ambiguity for the operators. If I have a barge and I load it in Nikiski, Alaska, and take it to Dutch Harbor, I have a planning standard that I meet and have met since they were adopted in the early 90s. When this issue was identified, the implication was if that barge now leaves Dutch Harbor and goes to Nome and unloads fuel on a ship-to-ship transfer to smaller vessels to go up the rivers, its planning standard changes significantly. And it changes to a point where it's physically impossible to have the equipment available. But more importantly, we were concerned that in the event of a casualty, even if you were in compliance with your contingency plan as a quote-unquote tank barge, you could still have problems with your insurance coverage because under that definition, you could now all of a sudden morph into a tank, a terminal, at which point these other measures come into play. And over the last several years, there's been an increase, as Mr. O'Shea mentioned, with ship-to-ship transfers operating in Western Alaska just because the nature of the source of fuel that comes into support the residential communities in that throughout that region. I'd like to thank the chair, McCabe, and his staff for navigating through lawyers, DEC agency people, and industry people to come up with what seems to be a very workable solution. Particularly Section 3 of the bill makes clear that as long as a vessel has contingency plans and financial responsibility in place, it doesn't all of a sudden convert into a different type of an entity just because it's delivering fuel one way versus another. I also like to appreciate the fact that Section 4 is in place. The fuel delivery season is beginning. Ships are coming under charter, and the safe delivery of fuel, which is on everybody's mind, is something we'd like to undertake, but make sure there's no confusion in the statute or with the agency or the industry. So I'd be available for any questions, and I'll be considerate of your time. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? It appears no questions from the committee. And I just want to note for the record, we also have Tiffany Larson. She is the Director of Spill and Prevention in the Department of Environmental Conservation. Ms. Larson, I believe you're here just to answer questions, but if you do have anything you want to say, I just wanted to give you a chance.
Yeah, good afternoon. For the record, Tiffany Larson, Division Director, Spill Prevention and Response. I think I would just add a point that is we're already at DEC doing what this bill proposes to achieve here, and have been for some time since the enactment of these statutes in the 90s. And so the legislation doesn't change what we're already doing. And the only concern that the department still has is the changing of the definition section, which is considered substantive law, right? If we change the definition, now we have to find everywhere in the statute where oil terminal facility exists and then see what other implications there are. But otherwise, we're doing this already at the department, and in the packet, you'll see the letters that the department's provided to the Alaska Fuel Group, I think is what we're calling them now, but AFSCA. And to clarify the department's expectations and what our requirements are presently. And so the department's on record already as achieving this without the statutory change. And the statutory change here is not what the department sought to change earlier in the year, and that was our regulations that Mr. Witt presented on earlier. So with that, I'm open for questions as well.
All right, thank you. Do we have any questions? I see no questions, and so before moving to public testimony, Mr. Witt, Representative McCabe, any further comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McCabe and I represent District 30, Transportation Committee Chair, and this was brought to me. And actually, AFSCA brought it to me because they were not worried about the DEC, who actually was doing what Ms. Larson said,
but because they were worried about their liability with an insurance company. So we know that insurance companies are in the business of limiting their risk. And if the, regardless of what DEC said, we know, you know, DEC said you're not doing anything illegal. This is the way we've been doing it. But the insurance company could still say, oh, you weren't doing it right, and now you're liable if there's a spill and you're on the hook for possibly millions of dollars of cleanup. So I think this was a good change. It was well discussed and well negotiated, as I said, by the stakeholders, and DEC played a very big and helpful role in that. And I want to be on the record for sure as saying how much I appreciate their help. So
thank you very much. So we'll now go to public testimony. I'll open public testimony on HB 128. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? If so, it looks like there's no one here to testify. And then is there anyone in the LIO or on phone that would like to testify? None noted, so it sounds like no public testimony. So with that, I will close public testimony. And we could take a brief at ease. Thank you. We're back, and so seeing and hearing no one else wishing to testify, I will say that do we have any final questions from committee members? Yes, comment, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment, as I grew up next to bulk fuel storage in Nome, and I'm very happy and thankful for the good work that our spill response teams do, and the Council of Fuel Storage does, and their Handlers Alliance, and so I'm very thankful for the concern they have to ensure that, you know, our practices match our statutory authority. And I just want to make sure that we are always in compliance with those two things. So thank you.
Thank you very much for those comments. So seeing no further discussion of this bill, we're going to set an amendment deadline for House Bill 128 for Thursday, May 4th at noon. Please deliver electronic and hard copy of any amendments to my office by that time. And with that, we're going to set this bill briefly aside. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator.
Record to briefly adjourn, so we are adjourning at 2:37 p.m. Tuesday, May 2nd.